Fiasco of Franz von Papen. There now appeared briefly on the center of the stage an unexpected and ludicrous figure. The man whom General von Schleicher foisted upon the octogenarian president, and who on June 1, 1932 was named Chancellor of Germany, was the 53-year-old Franz von Papen, scion of an impoverished family of the Westphalian nobility, a former general staff officer, a crack gentleman rider, an unsuccessful and amateurish Catholic centrist politician, a wealthy industrialist by marriage and little known to the public except as a former military attaché in Washington, who had been expelled during the war for complicity in the planning of such sabotage as blowing up bridges and railroad lines while the United States was neutral. "The president's choice met with incredulity," wrote the French ambassador in Berlin. No one but smiled or tittered or laughed, because Papen enjoyed the peculiarity of being taken seriously by neither his friends nor his enemies. He was reputed to be superficial, blundering, untrue, ambitious, vain, crafty, and an intriguer. To such a man, and Monsieur François Poncet was not exaggerating, Hindenburg, at Schleicher's prompting, had entrusted the fate of the floundering republic. Papen had no political backing whatsoever. He was not even a member of the Reichstag. The furthest he had got in politics was a seat in the Prussian Landtag. On his appointment as chancellor, his own center party, indignant at the treachery of Papen toward its leader, Brüning, unanimously expelled him from the party. But the president had told him to form a government above parties, and this he was able to do at once because Schleicher already had a list of ministers at hand. It comprised what became known as the Baron's Cabinet. 5 members were of the nobility, 2 were corporation directors, and 1, Franz Gürtner, named Minister of Justice, had been Hitler's protector in the Bavarian government during the troubled days before and after the Beer Hall Putsch. General von Schleicher was smoked out by Hindenburg from his preferred position behind the scenes and made Minister of Defense. The Baron's Cabinet was received by much of the country as a joke, though the stamina of a number of its members, Baron von Neurath, Baron von Eltz-Rubenach, Count Schwerin von Krosigk, and Dr. Gürtner, was such that they lingered on at their posts far into the era of the Third Reich. Papen's first act was to honor Schleicher's pact with Hitler. On June 4th, he dissolved the Reichstag and convoked new elections for July 31st. And after some prodding from the suspicious Nazis, he lifted the ban on the SA on June 15th. A wave of political violence and murder such as even Germany had not previously seen immediately followed. The stormtroopers swarmed the streets seeking battle and blood, and their challenge was often met, especially by the communists. In Prussia alone, between June 1st and 20th, there were 461 pitched battles in the streets which cost 82 lives and seriously wounded 400 men. In July, 38 Nazis and 30 communists were listed among the 86 persons killed in riots. On Sunday, July 10th, 18 persons were done to death in the streets, and on the following Sunday, when the Nazis, under police escort, staged a march through Altona, a working-class suburb of Hamburg, 19 persons were shot dead and 285 wounded. The civil war, which the Baron's cabinet had been called in to halt, was growing steadily worse. All the parties, save the Nazis and the communists, demanded that the government take action to restore order. Papen responded by doing 2 things. He banned all political parades for the fortnight prior to the July 31st elections. And he took a step which was aimed not only at placating the Nazis, but at destroying one of the few remaining pillars of the Democratic Republic. On July 20th, he deposed the Prussian government and appointed himself Reich Commissioner for Prussia. This was a daring move toward the kind of authoritarian government he was seeking for the whole of Germany. Papen's excuse was that the Altona riots had shown the Prussian government could not maintain law and order. He also charged, on evidence hastily produced by Schleicher, that the Prussian authorities were in cahoots with the communists. When the socialist ministers refused to be deposed except by force, Papen obligingly supplied it. Martial law was proclaimed in Berlin, and General von Rundstedt, the local Reichswehr commander, sent a lieutenant and 12 men to make the necessary arrests. This was a development which was not lost on the men of the right who had taken over the federal power, nor did it escape Hitler's notice. There was no need to worry any longer that the forces of the left or even of the democratic center would put up serious resistance to the overthrow of the democratic system. In 1920, a general strike had saved the republic from being overthrown. Such a measure was debated now among the trade union leaders and the socialists and rejected as too dangerous. Thus, by deposing the constitutional Prussian government, Papen had driven another nail into the coffin of the Weimar Republic. It had taken, as he boasted, only a squad of soldiers to do it. For their part, Hitler and his lieutenants were determined to bring down not only the Republic, but Papen and his barons too. Goebbels expressed the aim in his diary on June 5th. "We must disassociate ourselves at the earliest possible moment from this transitional bourgeois cabinet." When Papen saw Hitler for the first time on June 9th, the Nazi leader told him, "I regard your cabinet only as a temporary solution and will continue my efforts to make my party the strongest in the country. The chancellorship will then devolve on me." The Reichstag elections of July 31st were the third national elections held in Germany within 5 months. But, far from being weary from so much electioneering, the Nazis threw themselves into the campaign with more fanaticism and force than ever before. Despite Hitler's promise to Hindenburg that the Nazis would support the Papen government, Goebbels unleashed bitter attacks on the Minister of the Interior, and as early as July 9th, Hitler went to Schleicher and complained bitterly of the government's policies. From the size of the crowds that turned out to see Hitler, it was evident that the Nazis were gaining ground. In one day, July 27th, he spoke to 60,000 persons in Brandenburg, to nearly as many in Potsdam, and that evening to 120,000 massed in the giant Grunewald Stadium in Berlin, while outside an additional 100,000 heard his voice by loudspeaker. The polling on July 31st brought a resounding victory for the National Socialist Party. With 13,745,000 votes, the Nazis won 230 seats in the Reichstag, making them easily the largest party in Parliament, though still far short of a majority in a house of 608 members. The Social Democrats, no doubt because of the timidity shown by their leaders in Prussia, lost 10 seats and were reduced to 133. The working class was swinging over to the Communists, who gained 12 seats and became the third largest party, with 89 members in the Reichstag. The Catholic Center increased its strength somewhat, from 68 to 73 seats, but the other middle-class parties, and even Hugenberg's German National Party, the only one which had supported Papen in the election, were overwhelmed. Except for the Catholics, the middle and upper classes, it was evident, had gone over to the Nazis. On August 2nd, Hitler took stock of his triumph at Tegernsee, near Munich, where he conferred with his party leaders. Since the last Reichstag elections, 2 years before, the National Socialists had gained over 7 million votes and increased their representation in Parliament from 107 to 230. In the 4 years since the 1928 elections, the Nazis had won some 13 million new votes. Yet the majority which would sweep the party into power still eluded Hitler. He had won only 37% of the total vote. The majority of Germans was still against him. Far into the night, he deliberated with his lieutenants. Goebbels recorded the results in his diary entry of August 2nd. "The Führer faces difficult decisions. Legal? With the center?" With the center, the Nazis could form a majority in the Reichstag. But to Goebbels, this is unthinkable. Still, he notes, "the Führer comes to no final decision. The situation will take a little time to ripen." But not much. Hitler, flushed with his victory, though it was less than decisive, was impatient. On August 4th, he hurried to Berlin to see not Chancellor von Papen, but General von Schleicher, and, as Goebbels noted, to present his demands. "They will not be too moderate," he added. On August 5th, at the Fürstenberg barracks near Berlin, Hitler outlined his terms to General von Schleicher. The chancellorship for himself, and for his party, the premiership of Prussia, the Reich and Prussian Ministries of Interior, the Reich Ministries of Justice, Economy, and Aviation, and a new ministry for Goebbels, that of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. As a sop to Schleicher, Hitler promised him the defense ministry. Furthermore, Hitler said he would demand an enabling act from the Reichstag, authorizing him to rule by decree for a specified period. If it were refused, the Reichstag would be sent home. Hitler left the meeting convinced that he had won over Schleicher to his program and hurried south in good spirits to his mountain retreat on the Obersalzberg. Goebbels, always cynical in regard to the opposition and always distrustful of the political general, was not so sure. "It is well to be skeptical about further developments," he confided to his diary on August 6th after he had listened to the leader's optimistic report of his meeting with Schleicher. Goebbels was sure of one thing, though. "Once we have the power, we will never give it up. They will have to carry our dead bodies out of the ministries." All was not as well as Hitler seemed to think. On August 8th, Goebbels wrote, "Telephone call from Berlin. It is full of rumors. The whole party is ready to take over power. The SA men are leaving their places of work in order to make themselves ready. The party leaders are preparing for the great hour. If all goes well, fine. If things go badly, there will be a terrible setback." The next day, Strasser, Frick, and Funk arrived at Obersalzberg with news that was not exactly encouraging. Schleicher was turning again, like a worm. He was now insisting that if Hitler got the chancellorship, he must rule with the consent of the Reichstag. Funk reported that his business friends were worried about the prospects of a Nazi government. He had a message from Schacht confirming it. Finally, the Wilhelmstrasse, the trio told Hitler, was worried about a Nazi putsch. This worry was not without foundation. Next day, August 10th, Goebbels learned that in Berlin the SA was in a state of armed readiness. "The SA is throwing an ever stronger ring around Berlin. The Wilhelmstrasse is very nervous about it. But that is the point of our mobilization." On the following day, the Führer could stand the waiting no longer. He set out by motor car for Berlin. He would make himself scarce there, Goebbels says, but on the other hand, he would be ready when he was called. When the call did not come, he himself requested to see the president. But first he had to see Schleicher and Papen. This interview took place at noon on August 13th. It was a stormy one. Schleicher had slid away from his position of a week before. He supported Papen in insisting that the most Hitler could hope for was the vice-chancellorship. Hitler was outraged. He must be chancellor or nothing. Papen terminated the interview by saying he would leave the final decision up to Hindenburg. Papen, in his memoirs, does not mention Schleicher's presence at this meeting, but it is clear from other sources that he was there. It is an important point in view of subsequent events. Hitler retired in a huff to the nearby Kaiserhof. There at 3 p.m., a phone call came from the president's office. Someone, probably Goebbels, judging from his diary, asked, "Has a decision already been made? If so, there is no point in Hitler's coming over." The president, the Nazis were told, wishes first to speak to Hitler. The aging field marshal received the Nazi leader standing up and leaning on his cane in his study, thus setting the icy tone for the interview. For a man in his 85th year who only 10 months before had suffered a complete mental relapse lasting more than a week, Hindenburg was in a surprisingly lucid frame of mind. He listened patiently while Hitler reiterated his demand for the chancellorship and full power. Otto von Meissner, chief of the presidential chancellery, and Goering, who had accompanied Hitler, were the only witnesses to the conversation, and though Meissner is not a completely dependable source, his affidavit at Nuremberg is the only first-hand testimony in existence of what followed. It has a ring of truth. Hindenburg replied that because of the tense situation, he could not in good conscience risk transferring the power of government to a new party such as the National Socialists, which did not command a majority and which was intolerant, noisy, and undisciplined. At this point, Hindenburg, with a certain show of excitement, referred to several recent occurrences, clashes between the Nazis and the police, acts of violence committed by Hitler's followers against those who were of a different opinion, excesses against Jews, and other illegal acts. All these incidents had strengthened him in his conviction that there were numerous wild elements in the party beyond control. After extended discussion, Hindenburg proposed to Hitler that he should declare himself ready to cooperate with the other parties, in particular with the right and center, and that he should give up the one-sided idea that he must have complete power. In cooperating with other parties, Hindenburg declared, he would be able to show what he could achieve and improve upon. If he could show positive results, he would acquire increasing and even dominating influence, even in a coalition government. Hindenburg stated that this also would be the best way to eliminate the widespread fear that a National Socialist government would make ill use of its power and would suppress all other viewpoints and gradually eliminate them. Hindenburg stated that he was ready to accept Hitler and the representatives of his movement in a coalition government, the precise combination to be a matter of negotiation, but that he could not take the responsibility of giving exclusive power to Hitler alone. Hitler was adamant, however, in refusing to put himself in the position of bargaining with the leaders of the other parties and in such manner to form a coalition government. The discussion then ended without agreement, but not before the old president, still standing, had delivered a stern lecture to the Nazi leader. In the words of the official communique issued immediately afterward, Hindenburg regretted that Herr Hitler did not see himself in a position to support a national government appointed with the confidence of the Reich president, as he had agreed to do before the Reichstag elections. In the view of the venerable president, Hitler had broken his word, but let him beware of the future. The president, the communique stated further, gravely exhorted Herr Hitler to conduct the opposition on the part of the NS party in a chivalrous manner, and to bear in mind his responsibility to the fatherland and to the German people. The communique giving Hindenburg's version of the meeting and insisting that Hitler had demanded complete control of the state was published in such a hurry that it caught Goebbels's propaganda machine napping and did much harm to Hitler's cause, not only among the general public but among the Nazis themselves. In vain did Hitler respond that he had not asked for complete power, but only for the chancellorship and a few ministries. Hindenburg's word was generally accepted. In the meantime, the mobilized stormtroopers were chafing at the bit. Hitler called in their leaders and spoke to them that same evening. "It's a difficult task," Goebbels noted. "Who knows if their formations can be held together? Nothing is more difficult than to tell victory-flushed troops that victory has been snatched out of their hand." Late that night, the little doctor sought consolation in the reading of the letters of Frederick the Great. Next day he raced off for a vacation on the beaches of the Baltic. "Great hopelessness reigns among the party comrades," he wrote. He declined to leave his room even to speak with them. "I don't want to hear about politics for at least a week. I want only sun, light, air, and peace." Hitler retired to the Obersalzberg to imbibe the same elements and ponder the immediate future. As Goebbels said, the first big chance has been missed. Hermann Rauschning, the then Nazi leader in Danzig, found the Führer brooding sullenly on his mountaintop. "We must be ruthless," Hitler told him, and launched into a tirade against Papen. But he had not lost hope. At times he spoke as if he were already chancellor. "My task is more difficult than Bismarck's," he said. "I must first create the nation before even beginning to tackle the national tasks before us." But supposing the Nazis were suppressed by a military dictatorship under Papen and Schleicher? Hitler abruptly asked Rauschning whether Danzig, an independent city-state then under the protection of the League of Nations, had an extradition agreement with Germany. Rauschning did not at first understand the question, but it later became evident that Hitler was looking for a place that might serve as an asylum. In his diary, Goebbels noted, "Rumors that the Führer is to be arrested." Yet even now, after his rebuff by the Reich president and the government of Papen and Schleicher, and despite his fears that his party might be outlawed, he was determined to stick to his path of legality. He squelched all talk of a putsch by the SA. Except for occasional spells of depression, he remained confident that he would achieve his goal. Not by force, and scarcely by winning a parliamentary majority, but by the means which had carried Schleicher and Papen to the top. By backstairs intrigue, a game that two could play. It was not long before he gave an example. On August 25th, Goebbels conferred with Hitler at Berchtesgaden and noted, "We have got into touch with the center party, if only to bring pressure on our opponents." Next day, Goebbels was back in Berlin, where he found that Schleicher had already found out about our feelers to the center. On the following day, he went to see the general just to make sure. He thought Schleicher appeared worried at the prospect of Hitler and the Catholic Center getting together, for between them they commanded an absolute majority in the Reichstag. As to Schleicher, Goebbels wrote, "I don't know what is genuine or false in him." The contacts with the center party, though never intended, as Goebbels said, to be much more than a means of applying pressure on the Papen government, paid off in a farcical event which now occurred in the Reichstag and which marked the beginning of the end for the cavalryman chancellor. When the chamber convened on August 30th, the centrists joined the Nazis in electing Göring president of the Reichstag. For the first time, then, a National Socialist was in the chair when the Reichstag reconvened on September 12th to begin its working session. Göring made the most of his opportunity. Chancellor von Papen had obtained in advance from the president a decree for the dissolution of the chamber, the first time that the death warrant of the Reichstag had been signed before it met to transact business. But for this first working session, he neglected to bring it along. He had with him instead a speech outlining the program of his government, having been assured that one of the nationalist deputies, in agreement with most of the other parties, would object to a vote on the expected communist motion for censure of the government. In this case, a single objection from any one of the 600-odd members was enough to postpone a vote. When Ernst Torgler, the communist leader, introduced his motion as an amendment to the order of the day, however, neither a nationalist deputy nor any other rose to object. Finally, Frick asked for a half-hour's adjournment on behalf of the Nazis. "The situation was now serious," Papen says in his memoirs, "and I had been caught unawares." He sent a messenger post-haste to the Chancellery to fetch the dissolution order. In the meantime, Hitler conferred with his parliamentary party group in the Reichstag President's Palace across the street. The Nazis were in a dilemma, and they were embarrassed. The nationalists, they felt, had double-crossed them by not moving to postpone the vote. Now, Hitler's party, in order to bring down the Papen government, would have to vote with the communists on a communist motion. Hitler decided to swallow the pill of such an unsavory association. He ordered his deputies to vote for the communist amendment and overthrow Papen before the chancellor could dissolve the Reichstag. To accomplish this, of course, Göring, as presiding officer, would have to pull some fast and neat tricks of parliamentary procedure. The former air ace, a man of daring and of many abilities, as he was to prove on a larger stage later, was equal to the occasion. When the session reconvened, Papen appeared with the familiar red dispatch case, which, by tradition, carried the dissolution order he had so hastily retrieved. But when he requested the floor to read it, the president of the Reichstag managed not to see him, though Papen, by now red-faced, was on his feet brandishing the paper for all in the assembly to see. All but Göring. His smiling face was turned the other way. He called for an immediate vote. By now, Papen's countenance, according to eyewitnesses, had turned from red to white with anger. He strode up to the president's rostrum and plunked the dissolution order on his desk. Göring took no notice of it and ordered the vote to proceed. Papen, followed by his ministers, none of whom were members of the chamber, stalked out. The deputies voted, 513-32 against the government. Only then did Göring notice the piece of paper which had been thrust so angrily on his desk. He read it to the assembly and ruled that since it had been countersigned by a chancellor who already had been voted out of office by a constitutional majority, it had no validity. Which elements in Germany gained and which lost by this farcical incident, and how much, was not immediately clear. That the dandy, Papen, had been made a joke of, there was no doubt. But then, he had always been somewhat of a joke, even, as Ambassador François Poncet said, to his friends. That the Reichstag had shown that the overwhelming majority of Germans opposed Hindenburg's hand-picked presidential government was clear enough. But in the process, had it not further sapped public confidence in the parliamentary system? As for the Nazis, had they not again shown themselves to be not only irresponsible, but ready to connive even with the communists to achieve their ends? Moreover, were the citizens not weary of elections? And did the Nazis not face losing votes in the inevitable new election, the fourth within the year? Gregor Strasser and even Frick thought that they did, and that such a loss might be disastrous to the party. Hitler, however, Goebbels reported that same evening, was beside himself with joy. Again, he has made a clear, unmistakable decision. The Reichstag quickly recognized its dissolution, and new elections were set for November 6th. For the Nazis, they presented certain difficulties. For one thing, as Goebbels noted, the people were tired of political speeches and propaganda. Even the party workers, as he admitted in his diary of October 15th, had become very nervous as the result of these everlasting elections. They are overworked. Also, there were financial difficulties. Big business and big finance were swinging behind Papen, who had given them certain concessions. They were becoming increasingly distrustful, as Funk had warned, of Hitler's refusal to cooperate with Hindenburg, and with what seemed to them his growing radicalism and his tendency to work even with the communists, as the Reichstag episode had shown. Goebbels took notice of this in his diary of October 15th. Money is extraordinarily hard to obtain. All the gentlemen of property and education are standing by the government. A few days before the election, the Nazis had joined the communists in staging a strike of the transport workers in Berlin, a strike disavowed by the trade unions and the socialists. This brought a further drying up of financial sources among the businessmen just when the Nazi Party needed funds most to make a whirlwind finish in the campaign. Goebbels noted lugubriously on November 1st, "Scarcity of money has become a chronic illness with us. We lack enough to really carry out a big campaign. Many bourgeois circles have been frightened off by our participation in the strike. Even many of our party comrades are beginning to have their doubts." On November 5th, the eve of the elections, "Last attack. Desperate drive of the party against defeat. We succeed in getting 10,000 marks at the last minute. This will be thrown into the campaign Saturday afternoon. We have done everything that could be done. Now let fate decide." Fate and the German electorate decided on November 6th a number of things, none of them conclusive for the future of the crumbling republic. The Nazis lost 2 million votes and 34 seats in the Reichstag, reducing them to 196 deputies. The communists gained 750,000 votes, and the Social Democrats lost the same number, with the result that the communist seats rose from 89 to 100, and the socialist seats dropped from 133 to 121. The German National Party, the sole one which had backed the government, won nearly 1 million additional votes, obviously from the Nazis, and now had 52 seats instead of 37. Though the National Socialists were still the largest party in the country, the loss of 2 million votes was a severe setback. For the first time, the great Nazi tide was ebbing, and from a point far short of a majority. The legend of invincibility had been shattered. Hitler was in a weaker position to bargain for power than he had been since July. Realizing this, Papen put aside what he calls his personal distaste for Hitler, and wrote him a letter on November 13th inviting him to discuss the situation. But Hitler made so many conditions in his reply that Papen abandoned all hope of obtaining an understanding with him. The Nazi leader's intransigence did not surprise the breezy and competent chancellor, but a new course which his friend and mentor, Schleicher, now proposed, did surprise him. For the slippery kingmaker had come to the conclusion that Papen's usefulness, like that of Brüning before him, had come to an end. New plans were sprouting in his fertile mind. His good friend Papen must go. The president must be left completely free to deal with the political parties, especially with the largest. He urged Papen's resignation, and on November 17th, Papen and his cabinet resigned. Hindenburg sent immediately for Hitler. Their meeting on November 19th was less frigid than that of August 13th. This time, the president offered chairs and allowed his caller to remain for over an hour. Hindenburg presented Hitler with two choices: the chancellorship if he could secure a workable majority in the Reichstag for a definite program, or the vice-chancellorship under Papen in another presidential cabinet that would rule by emergency decrees. Hitler saw the president again on the 21st, and he also exchanged several letters with Meissner, but there was no agreement. Hitler could not get a workable majority in parliament. Though the center party agreed to support him on condition that he would not aspire to dictatorship, Hugenberg withheld the cooperation of the nationalists. Hitler therefore resumed his demand for the chancellorship of a presidential government, but this the president would not give him. If there was to be a cabinet governing by decree, Hindenburg preferred his friend Papen to head it. Hitler, he said in a letter on his behalf dispatched by Meissner, could not be given such a post because such a cabinet is bound to develop into a party dictatorship. I cannot take the responsibility for this before my oath and my conscience. The old field marshal was more prophetic on the first point than on the second. As for Hitler, once more he had knocked on the door of the chancellery, had seen it open a crack, only to be slammed shut in his face. This was just what Papen had expected, and when he and Schleicher went to see Hindenburg on the evening of December 1st, he was sure that he would be reappointed chancellor. Little did he suspect what the scheming general had been up to. Schleicher had been in touch with Strasser and had suggested that if the Nazis would not come into a Papen government, perhaps they would join a cabinet in which he himself were chancellor. Hitler was asked to come to Berlin for consultations with the general, and according to one version widely publicized in the German press and later accepted by most historians, the Führer actually took the night train to Berlin from Munich, but was hauled off in the dead of the night by Göring at Jena, and spirited away to Weimar for a meeting of the top Nazi leaders. Actually, the Nazi version of this incident is, surprisingly, probably the more accurate. Goebbels's diary for November 30th recounts that a telegram came for Hitler asking him to hurry to Berlin, but that he decided to let Schleicher wait while he conferred with his comrades at Weimar, where he was scheduled to open the campaign for the Thuringian elections. At this conference, attended by the Big Five leaders, Göring, Goebbels, Strasser, Frick, and Hitler, on December 1st, there was considerable disagreement. Strasser, supported by Frick, urged at least Nazi toleration of a Schleicher government, though he himself preferred joining it. Göring and Goebbels argued strenuously against such a course, and Hitler sided with them. Next day, Hitler advised a certain Major Ott, whom Schleicher had sent to him, to counsel the general not to take the chancellorship, but it was too late. Papen had been blandly unaware of the intrigue which Schleicher was weaving behind his back. At the beginning of the meeting with the president on December 1st, he had confidently outlined his plans for the future. He should continue as chancellor, rule by decree, and let the Reichstag go hang for a while until he could amend the constitution. In effect, Papen wanted amendments which would take the country back to the days of the empire and re-establish the rule of the conservative classes. At his Nuremberg trial and in his memoirs, he admitted, as indeed he did to the field marshal, that his proposals involved a breach of the present constitution by the president. But he assured Hindenburg that he might be justified in placing the welfare of the nation above his oath to the constitution, as, he added, Bismarck once had done for the sake of the country. To Papen's great surprise, Schleicher broke in to object. He played upon the aged president's obvious reluctance to violate his oath to uphold the Constitution, if it could be avoided, and the general thought it could. He believed a government which could command a majority in the Reichstag was possible if he himself headed it. He was sure he could detach Strasser and at least 60 Nazi deputies from Hitler. To this Nazi fraction he could add the middle-class parties and the Social Democrats. He even thought the trade unions would support him. Hindenburg was shocked at such an idea and, turning to Papen, asked him then and there to go ahead with the forming of a new government. Schleicher, says Papen, appeared dumbfounded. They had a long argument after they had left the president, but could reach no agreement. As they parted, Schleicher, in the famous words addressed to Luther as he set out for the fateful Diet of Worms, said to Papen, "Little monk, you have chosen a difficult path." How difficult it was, Papen learned the next morning at 9 o'clock at a cabinet meeting which he had called. Schleicher rose, Papen says, and declared that there was no possibility of carrying out the directive that the president had given me. Any attempt to do so would reduce the country to chaos. The police and the armed services could not guarantee to maintain transport and supply services in the event of a general strike, nor would they be able to ensure law and order in the event of a civil war. The general staff had made a study in this respect, and he had arranged for Major Ott, its author, to place himself at the cabinet's disposal and present a report. Whereupon the general produced the major. If Schleicher's remarks had shaken Papen, the conveniently timed report of Major Eugen Ott, who would later be Hitler's ambassador to Tokyo, demolished him. Ott simply stated that the defense of the frontiers and the maintenance of order against both Nazis and communists was beyond the strength of the forces at the disposal of the federal and state governments. It is therefore recommended that the Reich government should abstain from declaring a state of emergency. To Papen's pained surprise, the German army, which had once sent the Kaiser packing and which more recently, at Schleicher's instigation, had eliminated General Gruner and Chancellor Brüning, was now cashiering him. He went immediately to Hindenburg with the news, hoping that the president would fire Schleicher as Minister of Defense and retain Chancellor Papen, and indeed proposing that he do so. "My dear Papen," the stout old president replied, "you will not think much of me if I change my mind, but I am too old and have been through too much to accept the responsibility for a civil war. Our only hope is to let Schleicher try his luck." Two great tears, Papen swears, rolled down Hindenburg's cheeks. A few hours later, as the deposed chancellor was clearing his desk, a photograph of the president arrived for him with the inscription, "Ich hat einen Kameraden." The next day, the president wrote him in his own handwriting of the heavy heart he felt in relieving him of his post, and reiterating that his confidence in him remains unshaken. That was true, and would shortly be proved. On December 2nd, Kurt von Schleicher became chancellor, the first general to occupy that post since General Count Georg Leo von Caprivi de Caprara de Montecuccoli, who had succeeded Bismarck in 1890. Schleicher's tortuous intrigues had at last brought him to the highest office at a moment when the Depression, which he little understood, was at its height, when the Weimar Republic, which he had done so much to undermine, was already crumbling, when no one any longer trusted him, not even the president, whom he had manipulated so long. His days on the heights, it seemed obvious to almost everyone but himself, were strictly numbered. The Nazis were sure of it. Goebbels's diary for December 2nd included this entry. "Schleicher is named chancellor. He won't last long." Papen thought so too. He was smarting from wounded vanity and thirsting for revenge against his friend and successor, as he calls him in his memoirs. To get Papen out of the way, Schleicher offered him the Paris embassy, but he declined. The president, Papen says, wanted him to remain in Berlin within reach. That was the most strategic place to weave his own web of intrigues against the arch-intriguer. Busy and agile as a spider, Papen set to work. As the strife-ridden year of 1932 approached its end, Berlin was full of cabals, and of cabals within cabals. Besides those of Papen and Schleicher, there was one at the president's palace, where Hindenburg's son Oscar and his state secretary Meissner held sway behind the throne. There was one at the Kaiserhof Hotel, where Hitler and the men around him were plotting not only for power, but against each other. Soon the webs of intrigue became so enmeshed that by New Year's 1933, none of the cabalists was sure who was double-crossing whom. But it would not take long for them to find out. Schleicher, the last chancellor of the Republic. "I stayed in power only 57 days, Schleicher remarked once in the hearing of the attentive French ambassador. "And on each and every one of them I was betrayed 57 times. Don't ever speak to me of German loyalty." His own career and doings had certainly made him an authority on the subject. He began his chancellorship by making Gregor Strasser an offer to become vice-chancellor of Germany and premier of Prussia. Having failed to get Hitler to join his government, Schleicher now tried to split the Nazis by this bait to Strasser. There was some reason to believe he might succeed. Strasser was the number two man in the party, and among the left-wing element, which really believed in a national socialism, he was more popular than Hitler. As leader of the party organization, he was in direct touch with all the provincial and local leaders and seemingly had earned their loyalty. He was now convinced that Hitler had brought the movement to a dead end. The more radical followers were going over to the communists. The party itself was financially bankrupt. In November, Fritz Thyssen had warned that he could make no further contributions to the movement. There were simply no funds to meet the payroll of thousands of party functionaries or to maintain the SA, which alone cost 2.5 million marks a week. The printers of the extensive Nazi press were threatening to stop the presses unless they received payment on overdue bills. Goebbels had touched on this in his diary on November 11th. "The financial situation of the Berlin organization is hopeless. Nothing but debts and obligations." And in December he was regretting that party salaries would have to be cut. Finally, the provincial elections in Thuringia on December 3rd, the day Schleicher called in Strasser, revealed a loss of 40% in the Nazi vote. It had become obvious, at least to Strasser, that the Nazis would never obtain office through the ballot. He therefore urged Hitler to abandon his all-or-nothing policy and take what power he could by joining in a coalition with Schleicher. Otherwise, he feared, the party would fall to pieces. He had been pressing this line for some months, and Goebbels's diary from midsummer to December is full of bitter references to Strasser's disloyalty to Hitler. The showdown came on December 5th at a meeting of the party leaders at the Kaiserhof in Berlin. Strasser demanded that the Nazis at least tolerate the Schleicher government, and he was backed by Frick, who headed the Nazi bloc in the Reichstag, many of whose members feared losing their seats and their deputies' salary if Hitler provoked any more elections. Goering and Goebbels strenuously opposed Strasser and won Hitler to their side. Hitler would not tolerate the Schleicher regime, but, it developed, he was still ready to negotiate with it. For this task, however, he appointed Goering. He had already heard Goebbels' reveals of Strasser's private talk with the Chancellor 2 days before. On the 7th, Hitler and Strasser had a conversation at the Kaiserhof that degenerated into a bitter quarrel. Hitler accused his chief lieutenant of trying to stab him in the back, oust him from his leadership of the party, and break up the Nazi movement. Strasser heatedly denied this, swore that he had been loyal, but accused Hitler of leading the party to destruction. Apparently, he left unsaid a number of things that had been swelling within him since 1925. Back at his room in the Excelsior Hotel, he put them all in writing in a letter to Hitler, which ended with his resignation of all his offices in the party. The letter, which reached Hitler on the 8th, fell, as Goebbels' diary says, like a bombshell. The atmosphere in the Kaiserhof was that of a graveyard. "We are all dejected and depressed," Goebbels noted. It was the greatest blow Hitler had suffered since he rebuilt the party in 1925. Now, on the threshold of power, his principal follower had deserted him and threatened to smash all he had built up in 7 years. "In the evening," Goebbels wrote, "the Führer comes to our home. It is difficult to be cheerful. We are all depressed, above all because of the danger of the whole party falling apart, and all our work having been in vain. Telephone call from Dr. Lai. The situation in the party worsens from hour to hour. The Führer must return immediately to the Kaiserhof." Goebbels was called to join him there at 2 o'clock in the morning. Strasser had given his story to the morning newspapers, which were just then appearing in the streets. Hitler's reaction was described by Goebbels. "Treason! Treason! Treason! For hours, the Führer paces up and down in the hotel room. He is embittered and deeply wounded by this treachery. Finally, he stops and says, 'If the party once falls to pieces, I'll put an end to it all in 3 minutes with a pistol shot.'" The party did not fall apart, and Hitler did not shoot himself. Strasser might have achieved both these ends, which would have radically altered the course of history, but at the crucial moment, he himself gave up. Frick, with Hitler's permission, had been searching all Berlin for him, it having been agreed that the quarrel must somehow be patched over to rescue the party from disaster. But Strasser, fed up with it all, had taken a train south for a vacation in sunny Italy. Hitler, always at his best when he detected weakness in an opponent, struck swiftly and hard. The political organization which Strasser had built up was taken over by the Führer himself, with Dr. Lai, the Gauleiter from Cologne, as his staff chief. Strasser's friends were purged, and all party leaders convoked to Berlin to sign a new declaration of loyalty to Adolf Hitler, which they did. The wily Austrian had once more extricated himself from a tight fix that might easily have proved disastrous. Gregor Strasser, whom so many had thought to be a greater man than Hitler, was quickly destroyed. "A dead man," Goebbels called him in his diary notation of December 9th. This was to become literally true within 2 years, when Hitler decided to settle accounts. On December 10th, the week after he had been tripped by General von Schleicher, Franz von Papen began to spin his own web of intrigues. Following a speech that evening to the exclusive Herrenklub, from whose aristocratic and wealthy members he had recruited his short-lived cabinet, he had a private talk with Baron Kurt von Schröder, the Cologne banker who had contributed funds to the National Socialist Party. He suggested that the financier arrange for him to see Hitler on the sly. In his memoirs, Papen claims that it was Schröder who made the suggestion, but admits that he agreed. By a strange coincidence, Wilhelm Kepler, Hitler's economic advisor and one of his contact men with business circles, made the same suggestion on behalf of the Nazi leader. The two men, who had been at such odds only a few weeks before, met in what they hoped was the greatest of secrecy at the home of Schröder in Cologne on the morning of January 4th. Papen was surprised when a photographer snapped him at the entrance, but gave it little thought until the next day. Hitler was accompanied by Hess, Himmler, and Kepler, but he left his aides in the parlor and retired to Schroeder's study, where he was closeted for 2 hours with Papen and their host. Though the conversation started badly, with Hitler complaining bitterly of the way Papen had treated the Nazis while chancellor, it soon developed to a point that was to prove fateful for both men and their country. This was a crucial moment for the Nazi chief. By a superhuman effort, he had kept the party intact after Strasser's defection. He had traveled up and down the country, addressing 3 and 4 meetings a day, exhorting the party leaders to keep together behind him. But Nazi spirits remained at a low ebb, and the party was financially bankrupt. Many were saying it was finished. Goebbels had reflected the general feeling in his diary the last week of the year. 1932 has brought us eternal bad luck. The past was difficult and the future looks dark and gloomy. All prospects and hopes have quite disappeared. Hitler, therefore, was not nearly in so favorable a position to bargain for power as he had been during the previous summer and autumn. But neither was Papen. He was out of office. In their adversity, their minds met. The terms on which they met are a matter of dispute. In his trial at Nuremberg and in his memoirs, Papen blandly maintained that, ever loyal to Schleicher, he merely suggested to Hitler that he join the general's government. In view, however, of Papen's long record of deceit, of his quite natural desire to present himself in the most favorable light at Nuremberg and in his book, and of subsequent events, it seems certain that Schroeder's quite different account, which was given at Nuremberg, is the more truthful one. The banker maintained that what Papen suggested was the replacement of the Schleicher government by a Hitler-Papen government in which the two of them would be co-equal. But Hitler said if he were made chancellor, it would be necessary for him to be the head of the government, but that supporters of Papen could go into his government as ministers when they were willing to go along with him in his policy of changing many things. These changes included elimination of social democrats, communists, and Jews from leading positions in Germany, and the restoration of order in public life. Von Papen and Hitler reached agreement in principle. They agreed that further details would have to be worked out and that this could be done in Berlin or some other convenient place. And in the greatest secrecy, of course. But to the consternation of Papen and Hitler, the newspapers in Berlin came out with flaming headlines on the morning of January 5th over accounts of the Cologne meeting, accompanied by editorial blasts against Papen for his disloyalty to Schleicher. The wily general had placed his spies with his usual acumen. One of them, Papen later learned, had been that photographer who had snapped his picture as he entered Schroeder's home. Besides his deal with Papen, Hitler got 2 other things out of the Cologne meeting which were of great value to him. He learned from the ex-chancellor that Hindenburg had not given Schleicher power to dissolve the Reichstag. This meant that the Nazis, with the help of the communists, could overthrow the general any time they wished. Secondly, out of the meeting came an understanding that West German business interests would take over the debts of the Nazi Party. 2 days after the Cologne talks, Goebbels noted pleasing progress in political developments, but still complained of the bad financial situation. 10 days later, on January 16th, he reported that the financial position of the party had fundamentally improved overnight. In the meantime, Chancellor Schleicher went about, with an optimism that was myopic to say the least, trying to establish a stable government. On December 15th, he made a fireside broadcast to the nation, begging his listeners to forget that he was a general, and assuring them that he was a supporter neither of capitalism nor of socialism, and that to him, concepts such as private economy or planned economy have lost their terrors. His principal task, he said, was to provide work for the unemployed and get the country back on its economic feet. There would be no tax increase, no more wage cuts. In fact, he was canceling the last cut in wages and relief which Papen had made. Furthermore, he was ending the agricultural quotas which Papen had established for the benefit of the large landowners, and instead was launching a scheme to take 800,000 acres from the bankrupt Junker estates in the east and give them to 25,000 peasant families. Also, prices of such essentials as coal and meat would be kept down by rigid control. This was a bid for the support of the very masses which he had hitherto opposed or disregarded, and Schleicher followed it up with conversations with the trade unions, to whose leaders he gave the impression that he envisaged a future in which organized labor and the army would be twin pillars of the nation. but labor was not to be taken in by a man whom it profoundly mistrusted, and it declined its cooperation. The industrialists and the big landowners, on the other hand, rose up in arms against the new chancellor's program, which they clamored was nothing less than Bolshevism. The businessmen were aghast at Schleicher's sudden friendliness to the unions. The owners of large estates were infuriated at his reduction of agricultural protection and livid at the prospect of his breaking up the bankrupt estates in the East. On January 12th, the Landbund, the Association of the Larger Farmers, bitterly attacked the government, and its leaders, two of whom were Nazis, called on the president with their protests. Hindenburg, now a Junker landowner himself, called his chancellor to account. Schleicher's answer was to threaten to publish a secret Reichstag report on the Osthilfe, Eastern Relief, loans, a scandal which, as everyone knew, implicated hundreds of the oldest Junker families, who had waxed fat on unredeemed government loans, and which indirectly involved even the president himself, since the East Prussian estate which had been presented to him had been illegally deeded to his son to escape inheritance taxes. Despite the uproar among the industrialists and landowners and the coolness of the trade unions, Schleicher remained unaccountably confident that all was going well. On New Year's Day, 1933, he and his cabinet called on the aged president, who proceeded to express his gratitude that the gravest hardships are overcome and the upward path is now open to us. On January 4th, the day Papen and Hitler were conferring in Cologne, the chancellor arranged for Strasser, who had returned from his holiday in the Italian sun, to see Hindenburg. The former number two Nazi, when he saw the president a few days later, expressed willingness to join the Schleicher cabinet. This move threw consternation into the Nazi camp, which at the moment was pitched in the tiny state of Lippe, where Hitler and all his principal aides were fighting furiously to score a local election success in order to improve the Führer's bargaining position with Papen. Goebbels recounts the arrival of Göring at midnight of January 13th with the bad news of Strasser and of how the party chiefs had sat up all night discussing it, agreeing that if he took office it would be a grave setback to the party. Schleicher thought so too, and on January 15th, when Kurt von Schuschnigg, then the Austrian Minister of Justice, visited him, he assured him that Herr Hitler was no longer a problem, his movement had ceased to be a political danger, and the whole problem had been solved. It was a thing of the past. But Strasser did not come into the cabinet, nor did the leader of the Nationalist Party, Hugenberg, who on the day before, the 14th, had assured Hindenburg that he would. Both men soon turned to Hitler, Strasser to be turned down cold, and Hugenberg with more success. On January 15th, at the very moment when Schleicher was gloating to Schuschnigg about the end of Hitler, the Nazis scored a local success in the elections of Little Lippe. It was not much of an achievement. The total vote was only 90,000, of which the Nazis obtained 38,000, or 39%, an increase of some 17% over their previous poll. But, led by Goebbels, the Nazi leaders beat the drums over their victory, and strangely enough it seems to have impressed a number of conservatives, including the men behind Hindenburg, of whom the principal ones were State Secretary Meissner and the president's son, Oscar. On the evening of January 22nd, these two gentlemen stole out of the presidential quarters, grabbed a taxi, as Meissner says, to avoid being noticed, and drove to the suburban home of a hitherto unknown Nazi by the name of Joachim von Ribbentrop, who was a friend of Papen. They had served together on the Turkish front during the war. There they met Papen, Hitler, Göring, and Frick. According to Meissner, Oskar von Hindenburg had been opposed to any truck with the Nazis up to this fateful evening. Hitler may have known this. At any rate, he insisted on having a talk with him under four eyes, and to Meissner's astonishment, young Hindenburg assented and withdrew with Hitler to another room where they were closeted together for an hour. What Hitler said to the president's son, who was not noted for a brilliant mind or a strong character, has never been revealed. It was generally believed in Nazi circles that Hitler made both offers and threats, the latter consisting of hints to disclose to the public Oskar's involvement in the Osthilfe scandal and the tax evasion on the Hindenburg estate. One can only judge the offers by the fact that a few months later, 5,000 tax-free acres were added to the Hindenburg family property at Neudeck, and that in August 1934 Oskar was jumped from colonel to major general in the army. At any rate, there is no doubt that Hitler made a strong impression on the president's son. In the taxi on the way back, Meissner later recounted in his affidavit at Nuremberg, Oskar von Hindenburg was extremely silent, and the only remark which he made was that it could not be helped. The Nazis had to be taken into the government. My impression was that Hitler had succeeded in getting him under his spell. It only remained for Hitler to cast the spell over the father. This admittedly was more difficult, for whatever the old field marshal's deficiencies of mind, age had not softened his granite character. More difficult, but not impossible. Papen, busy as a beaver, was working daily on the old man, and it was easy to see that for all his cunning, Schleicher was fast stumbling to a fall. He had failed to win over the Nazis or to split them. He could get no backing from the Nationalists, the Center, or the Social Democrats. On January 23rd, therefore, Schleicher went to see Hindenburg, admitted that he could not find a majority in the Reichstag, and demanded its dissolution and emergency powers to rule by decree under Article 48 of the Constitution. According to Meissner, the general also asked for the temporary elimination of the Reichstag and frankly acknowledged that he would have to transform his government into a military dictatorship. Despite all his devious plotting, Schleicher was back where Papen had been early in December, but their roles were now reversed. Then Papen had demanded emergency powers, and Schleicher had opposed him and proposed that he himself form a majority government with the backing of the Nazis. Now the general was insisting on dictatorial rule, and the sly fox Papen was assuring the field marshal that he himself could corral Hitler for a government that would have a majority in the Reichstag. Such are the ups and downs of rogues and intriguers. Hindenburg, reminding Schleicher of the reasons he had given on December 2nd for upsetting Papen, informed him that they still held good. He bade him return to his task of finding a Reichstag majority. Schleicher was finished, and he knew it. So did everyone else who was in on the secret. Goebbels, one of the few in on it, commented the next day, "Schleicher will fall any moment, he who brought down so many others." His end came finally and officially on January 28th, when he called on the president and tendered the resignation of his government. "I have already one foot in the grave, and I am not sure that I shall not regret this action in heaven later on," Hindenburg told the disillusioned general. "After this breach of trust, sir, I am not sure that you will go to heaven," Schleicher replied, and quickly faded out of German history. At noon of the same day, Papen was entrusted by the president to explore the possibilities of forming a government under Hitler within the terms of the Constitution. For a week, this sly, ambitious man had been flirting with the idea of double-crossing Hitler after all and becoming chancellor again of a presidential government backed by Hugenberg. On January 27th, Goebbels noted, "There is still the possibility that Papen will again be made chancellor." The day before, Schleicher had sent the commander-in-chief of the army, General von Hammerstein, to the president to warn him against selecting Papen. In the maze of intrigues with which Berlin was filled, Schleicher was at the last minute plumping for Hitler to replace him. Hindenburg assured the army commander he had no intention of appointing that Austrian corporal. The next day, Sunday, January 29th, was a crucial one, with the conspirators playing their last desperate hands and filling the capital with the most alarming and conflicting rumors, not all of them groundless by any means. Once more Schleicher dispatched the faithful Hammerstein to stir up the brew. The army chief sought out Hitler to warn him once again that Papen might leave him out in the cold, and that it might be wise for the Nazi leader to ally himself with the fallen chancellor and the army. Hitler was not much interested. He returned to the Kaiserhof to have cakes and coffee with his aides, and it was at this repast that Goering appeared with the tidings that the Führer would be named Chancellor on the morrow. That night the Nazi chieftains were celebrating the momentous news at Goebbels's home on the Reichskanzlerplatz, when another emissary from Schleicher arrived with startling news. This was Werner von Alvensleben, a man so given to conspiracy that when one did not exist he invented one. He informed the jubilant party that Schleicher and Hammerstein had put the Potsdam garrison on an alarm footing and were preparing to bundle the old president off to Neudeck and establish a military dictatorship. This was a gross exaggeration. It is possible that the two generals were playing with the idea, but most certain that they had not taken any action. The Nazis, however, became hysterical with alarm. Goering hastened as fast as his bulk allowed across the square to alert the president and Papen. What Hitler did, he later described himself. My immediate counteraction to this planned military putsch was to send for the commander of the Berlin SA, Count von Helldorff, and through him to alert the whole SA of Berlin. At the same time, I instructed Major Wecker of the police, whom I knew I could trust, to prepare for a sudden seizure of the Wilhelmstrasse by 6 police battalions. Finally, I instructed General von Blomberg, who had been selected as Reichswehr Minister-elect, to proceed at once on arrival in Berlin at 8 a.m. on January 30th, direct to the old gentleman to be sworn in, and thus to be in a position as Commander-in-Chief of the Reichswehr to suppress any possible attempts at a coup d'état. Behind the backs of Schleicher and the Commander-in-Chief of the Army, everything in this frenzied period was being done behind someone's back. General Werner von Blomberg had been summoned, not by Hitler, who was not yet in power, but by Hindenburg, and Papen from Geneva, where he was representing Germany at the disarmament conference, to become the new Minister of Defense in the Hitler-Papen cabinet. He was a man who, as Hitler later said, already enjoyed his confidence, and who had come under the spell of his chief of staff in East Prussia, Colonel Walter von Reichenau, an outspoken Nazi sympathizer. When Blomberg arrived in Berlin early on the morning of January 30th, he was met at the station by 2 army officers with conflicting orders for him. A Major von Kunzen, Hammerstein's adjutant, commanded him to report to the commander-in-chief of the army. Colonel Oskar von Hindenburg, adjutant to his father, ordered the bewildered Blomberg to report to the President of the Republic. Blomberg went to the President, was immediately sworn in as defense minister, and thus was given the authority not only to put down any attempted coup by the army, but to see that the military supported the new government, which a few hours later would be named. Hitler was always grateful to the army for accepting him at that crucial moment. Not long afterward, he told a party rally, "If in the days of our revolution the army had not stood on our side, then we would not be standing here today." It was a responsibility which would weigh heavily on the officer corps in the days to come, and which, in the end, they would more than regret. On this wintry morning of January 30th, 1933, the tragedy of the Weimar Republic, of the bungling attempt for 14 frustrating years of the Germans to make democracy work, had come to an end. But not before, at the very last moment, as the final curtain fell, a minor farce took place among the motley group of conspirators gathered to bury the Republican regime. Papen later described it. At about 10:30, the members of the proposed cabinet met in my house and walked across the garden to the presidential palace, where we waited in Meissner's office. Hitler immediately renewed his complaints about not being appointed commissioner for Prussia. He felt that this severely restricted his power. I told him the Prussian appointment could be left until later. To this Hitler replied that if his powers were to be thus limited, he must insist on new Reichstag elections. This produced a completely new situation, and the debate became heated. Hugenberg, in particular, objected to the idea, and Hitler tried to pacify him by stating that he would make no changes in the cabinet, whatever the result might be. By this time it was long past 11 o'clock, the time that had been appointed for our interview with the president, and Meissner asked me to end our discussion, as Hindenburg was not prepared to wait any longer. We had had such a sudden clash of opinions that I was afraid our new coalition would break up before it was born. At last we were shown in to the president, and I made the necessary formal introductions. Hindenburg made a short speech about the necessity of full cooperation in the interests of the nation, and we were then sworn in. The Hitler cabinet had been formed. In this way, by way of the back door, by means of a shabby political deal with the old-school reactionaries he privately detested, the former tramp from Vienna, the derelict of the First World War, the violent revolutionary, became chancellor of the great nation. To be sure, the National Socialists were in a decided minority in the government. They had only 3 of the 11 posts in the cabinet, and except for the chancellorship, these were not key positions. Frick was Minister of the Interior, but he did not control the police as this minister did in most European countries. The police in Germany were in the hands of the individual states. The 3rd Nazi cabinet member was Goering, but no specific office could be found for him. He was named Minister Without Portfolio, with the understanding that he would become Minister of Aviation as soon as Germany had an air force. Little noticed was the naming of Göring to be also Minister of the Interior of Prussia, an office that controlled the Prussian police. For the moment, public attention was focused on the Reich cabinet. Goebbels's name, to the surprise of many, did not appear in it. Momentarily, he was left out in the cold. The important ministries went to the conservatives, who were sure they had lassoed the Nazis for their own ends. Neurath continued as Minister of Foreign Affairs. Blomberg was Minister of Defense. Hugenberg took over the combined ministries of economy and agriculture. Zelte, the Stahlheim leader, was made Minister of Labor. The other ministries were left in the hands of non-party experts, whom Papen had appointed 8 months before. Papen himself was vice-chancellor of the Reich and premier of Prussia, and Hindenburg had promised him that he would not receive the chancellor except in the company of the vice-chancellor. This unique position, he was sure, would enable him to put a brake on the radical Nazi leader. But even more, this government was Papen's conception, his creation, and he was confident that with the help of the staunch old president, who was his friend, admirer, and protector, and with the knowing support of his conservative colleagues, who outnumbered the obstreperous Nazis 8-3, he would dominate it. But this frivolous, conniving politician did not know Hitler. No one really knew Hitler, nor did he comprehend the strength of the forces which had spewed him up. Nor did Papen, or anyone else, except Hitler, quite realize the inexplicable weakness that now bordered on paralysis of existing institutions, the army, the churches, the trade unions, the political parties, or of the vast non-Nazi middle class and the highly organized proletariat, all of which, as Papen mournfully observed much later, would give up without a fight. No class or group or party in Germany could escape its share of responsibility for the abandonment of the Democratic Republic and the advent of Adolf Hitler. The cardinal error of the Germans who opposed Nazism was their failure to unite against it. At the crest of their popular strength in July 1932, the National Socialists had attained but 37% of the vote. But the 63% of the German people who expressed their opposition to Hitler were much too divided and short-sighted to combine against a common danger which they must have known would overwhelm them unless they united, however temporarily, to stamp it out. The communists, at the behest of Moscow, were committed to the last to the silly idea of first destroying the social democrats, the socialist trade unions, and what middle-class democratic forces there were, on the dubious theory that although this would lead to a Nazi regime, it would be only temporary and would bring inevitably the collapse of capitalism, after which the communists would take over and establish the dictatorship of the proletariat. Fascism, in the Bolshevik Marxist view, represented the last stage of a dying capitalism. After that, the communist deluge. 14 years of sharing political power in the Republic, of making all the compromises that were necessary to maintain coalition governments, had sapped the strength and the zeal of the Social Democrats until their party had become little more than an opportunist pressure organization, determined to bargain for concessions for the trade unions on which their strength largely rested. It might be true, as some socialists said, that fortune had not smiled on them. The communists, unscrupulous and undemocratic, had split the working class. The Depression had further hurt the Social Democrats, weakening the trade unions and losing the party the support of millions of unemployed, who in their desperation turned either to the communists or the Nazis. But the tragedy of the Social Democrats could not be explained fully by bad luck. They had had their chance to take over Germany in November 1918 and to found a state based on what they had always preached, social democracy. But they lacked the decisiveness to do so. Now, at the dawn of the third decade, they were a tired, defeatist party, dominated by old, well-meaning but mostly mediocre men. Loyal to the Republic they were to the last, but in the end too confused, too timid to take the great risks which alone could have preserved it, as they had shown by their failure to act when Papen turned out a squad of soldiers to destroy constitutional government in Prussia. Between the left and the right, Germany lacked a politically powerful middle class, which in other countries, in France and England, in the United States, had proved to be the backbone of democracy. In the first year of the Republic, the middle-class parties, the Democrats, the People's Party, the Center, had polled a total of 12 million votes, only 2 million less than the two socialist groups. But thereafter, their strength had waned as their supporters gravitated toward Hitler and the Nationalists. In 1919, the Democrats had elected 74 members to the Reichstag. By 1932, they held just 2 seats. The strength of the People's Party fell from 62 seats in 1920 to 11 seats in 1932. Only the Catholic Center retained its voting strength to the end. In the first Republican elections in 1919, the Center had 71 deputies in the Reichstag. In 1932, it had 70. But even more than the Social Democrats, the Center Party since Bismarck's time had been largely opportunist, supporting whatever government made concessions to its special interests. And though it seemed to be loyal to the Republic and to subscribe to its democracy, its leaders, as we have seen, were negotiating with the Nazis to give Hitler the chancellorship before they were outbid by Papen and the Nationalists. If the German Republic was bereft of a middle-of-the-road political class, it also lacked that stability provided in many other countries by a truly conservative party. The German Nationalists, at their peak in 1924, had polled 6 million votes and sent 103 deputies to the Reichstag, in which they formed the second-largest party. But then, as at almost all times during the Weimar regime, they refused to take a responsible position either in the government or in opposition, the only exception being their participation in 2 short-lived cabinets in the 20s. What the German right, whose vote went largely to the Nationalists, wanted was an end to the Republic and a return to an imperialist Germany in which all of their old privileges would be restored. Actually, the Republic had treated the right, both as individuals and as classes, with the utmost generosity, and, considering their aim, with exceptional tolerance. It had, as we have seen, allowed the army to maintain a state within a state, the businessmen and bankers to make large profits, the Junkers to keep their uneconomic estates by means of government loans that were never repaid and seldom used to improve their land. Yet this generosity had won neither their gratitude nor their loyalty to the Republic. With a narrowness, a prejudice, a blindness which, in retrospect, seemed inconceivable to this chronicler, they hammered away at the foundations of the Republic until, in alliance with Hitler, they brought it down. In the former Austrian vagabond, the conservative classes thought they had found a man who, while remaining their prisoner, would help them attain their goals. The destruction of the Republic was only the first step. What they then wanted was an authoritarian Germany, which at home would put an end to democratic nonsense and the power of the trade unions, and in foreign affairs, undo the verdict of 1918, tear off the shackles of Versailles, rebuild a great army, and with its military power, restore the country to its place in the sun. These were Hitler's aims, too, and though he brought what the conservatives had lacked, a mass following, the right was sure that he would remain in its pocket. Was he not outnumbered 8-3 in the Reich cabinet? Such a commanding position also would allow the conservatives, or so they thought, to achieve their ends without the barbarism of unadulterated Nazism. Admittedly, they were decent, God-fearing men, according to their lights. The Hohenzollern Empire had been built on the armed triumphs of Prussia, the German Republic on the defeat by the Allies after a great war. But the Third Reich owed nothing to the fortunes of war or to foreign influence. It was inaugurated in peacetime, and peacefully, by the Germans themselves, out of both their weaknesses and their strengths. The Germans imposed the Nazi tyranny on themselves. Many of them, perhaps a majority, did not quite realize it at that noon hour of January 30, 1933, when President Hindenburg, acting in a perfectly constitutional manner, entrusted the chancellorship to Adolf Hitler. But they were soon to learn.